Three, two, one. Boom. Here we go. Hello, Peter.
Joe.
Good to see
nice
you, buddy.
Nice to see you again.
I like how you have
at least, but nice to see you.
I like how you have the Euro-Pacific capital above your left shoulder. Very nice. Very wise.
Well, this is my studio in my basement here in Connecticut, where I'm hunkered down. Important thing that you have to recognize is that government spending is taxation. And what happened to government spending under Trump, even before it went through the moon with COVID-19? And we'll get to all the COVID stuff. But even before then, Trump signed on to all kinds of increases in government spending. More spending on the military, more spending welfare, huge increases in government spending. Those are tax hikes. Now, Trump cut income taxes, but the income tax is just one way the government pays for spending. Because all government spending has to be paid for by the public, one way or another. We don't get any government for free. Everything the government does costs us money. So every dime they spend represents taxation in some form. And what they've been doing is they've been printing money, right? The Federal Reserve prints money. And in fact, right now, the Federal Reserve is printing about 55 cents out of every federal dollar that's spent. So more money is being printed and spent than collected in taxation. But all that printing, all that spending that is being paid for by a printing press, we don't get that for free. There is a cost. See, when the government takes our money through an income tax, they take my money that I earned and they give it to somebody else who didn't earn it. And now that person spends the money. But because I don't have it, I can't spend it. I can't invest it or save it. I don't have it anymore. The government took it from me in taxes. But if the government doesn't take it from me, they just print money and they hand it to somebody else who didn't earn it and didn't do any work, didn't produce any goods or provide any services. They just, you know, got money from the government. That still costs me, because what happens is when that money is spent in a circulation, it bids up prices. And so prices are now higher than they would have been had that new money not been printed. And so now everything that I want to buy costs more than it otherwise would have cost. Either the prices went up or it prevented prices from going down. And so now my purchasing power has been diminished. And so either the government takes your money through an income tax or a sales tax or something, or they take your purchasing power through an inflation tax. And so that's what Trump decided to do, to pay for government through inflation rather than taxation. But what we know from history is that is the most expensive way to pay for government. And in fact, it hits hardest the middle class and the poor, right? Because the rich have a lot of assets. They have a lot of debt, where they, not consumer debt like on a credit card, but where they borrow money to accumulate income producing property, to buy companies, stocks, things like that. And so inflation helps those people, right? If you have debt to buy assets, inflation wipes out your debt. But if you're just saving money and working for a living and getting a paycheck, the inflation tax is very heavy on you. And that inflation tax is going to get much, much higher under Biden. Right. For all the talk about all these big government programs, and we'll talk about that, that he wants to pay for by taxing the rich aren't going to pay those taxes. Most of the money is going to come from the poor and the middle class through the inflation tax. But getting back to, you know, where I think Trump went wrong. So Trump gets into office and he had promised to make America great again. And the reason that America is not great is because government is too big. Right. When America was great, right, we had very, very small government. Government was, you know, an afterthought, right? On all levels, maybe state, federal, and local, maybe it was 5% of GDP. We didn't have an income tax, corporate or personal. We didn't have Social Security. We didn't have all, you know, minimum wage or any of these laws. We had a very, very tiny government. And because government was tiny, the economy got very big. We had all kinds of freedom. And because we were free, we were very productive and the living standards were rising and we were eradicating poverty. We were making all kinds of strides. The greatest economy in the history of the world was produced from the freest people in the history of the world, which was the United States. Well, Trump wanted to make America great again. The only way to do that would be to shrink government, cut government spending, and free up all those resources back into the private sector so that they can be used efficiently again. But the problem is, how do you cut government spending when every single program has its own constituency that benefits from it? And so once you're there, you can't cut anything unless you're willing to stand up to all the politicians and the special interest groups And apparently Trump wasn't willing to do that. I mean, Trump, when he got into office, became a politician. Or maybe he was one when he ran for office, but he was more concerned about getting reelected, which is a shame because he probably won't. He should have used the bully pulpit and used his office right away to level with the American public, to look them square in the eye and tell them that government is too big and spending needs to be cut, including things like Social Security and Medicare and all these sacred cows that nobody would gore. Trump should have been the guy to do it. He should have said, the buck stops with me. I don't care if I don't have a second term. And he should have vetoed all of those bills that he signed. He never should have agreed to allowing the debt ceiling to go up. He should have enforced that debt. So we now have $26.5 trillion of debt, right? When he came into office, it was just under $20 trillion. So we've already added $6.5 trillion since he became president. I would not have allowed the debt ceiling to go up at all, not one nickel. And I would have forced the government to cut government spending. And that's what Trump should have done. But he didn't want to do it because he was more concerned about the politics of it.
When you say I would, are you running for president? Are you ready to do this?
No, I'm just saying what I would have done had I been Trump.
Are you ready to do this, Peter? Are you ready to do this?
I'm not running.
But we need someone who understands.
It would be interesting. I could be the first Puerto Rican president. In fact, I'd be did you ever watch the Sweat Hogs?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, I'm on Epstein. I'm a Puerto Rican Jew.
Epstein played my brother in an episode of News Radio.
Really?
Yes. He played my older brother, who was a priest, who beat us up.
Yeah.
It was
Gabriel
fun.
Kaplan's show. That was the 1970s. But yeah, yes. I could be a Puerto Rican Jew.
Yeah, there you go.
I can't vote, right? I can't vote for the president, but I can run. In fact, I could be the only person elected president who couldn't vote for himself.
That's hilarious. Now, I'm so glad you're on here today because you have a unique ability to illuminate all these areas of finance and taxing and Wall Street that most people just simply don't have the understanding or the knowledge to lay out for the layperson like myself. When you look...
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And, you know, you've got a great audience, and I'm hoping to clear up a lot of misconception out there because I've been saying, you know, the only thing that spreads faster than the coronavirus is ignorance, you know, about economics, about finance. And so I want to clear that up. And, you know, a good place to get started is to really talk about the current state of the U.S. economy and where we were, right, leading up to COVID-19. Because, you know, Donald Trump is out there claiming that we had this great economy, right, that just got screwed up by COVID-19. We had to shut it down. But we didn't. We had an enormous bubble. There was nothing great about it other than the size of the bubble. And the reason that it collapsed so quickly was because what happened was COVID-19 was a pin that pricked that bubble. In fact, the bubble was already deflating before COVID. It started to deflate in the fourth quarter of 2019. That's when the Federal Reserve stopped hiking interest rates and then started cutting them again and started doing quantitative easing again. And then COVID-19 came. It was like a giant spear that put a gaping hole into a bubble that was already deflating.
Can I pause you there, Peter? Why did that happen? Why did that process take place before COVID-19?
Well, because again, Trump was very critical of Janet Yellen during the Obama years, rightly so, because Yellen kept interest rates artificially low to make Obama look good by propping up the stock market and the real estate market with cheap money. But doing that is what prevented a real recovery that would have benefited Main Street. And so those are the people that Trump was tapping into. The guys on Main Street that were getting screwed as the guys on Wall Street were being enriched by bad monetary policy. So Trump was right to criticize Yellen. And then he didn't want to reappoint her because supposedly he was going to reappoint somebody that would do the right thing. But as Powell was doing the right thing, albeit too slowly, Powell started to correct the problem by raising interest rates and shrinking the balance sheet. But when that began to impact the markets, Trump was like, oh, he started criticizing him. You know, we're going to fire you. You're a terrible Fed chairman. He was doing the right thing. We need higher interest rates. And unfortunately, higher interest rates means the stock market's going to go down. I mean, that's just the reality. The real estate market's going to go down. You know, we're addicted to cheap money like a drug addict is addicted to heroin. But if you've got a guy addicted to heroin, the solution isn't more heroin so he stays high. The solution is, okay, no more heroin, and now you're going to go through withdrawal. So the economy started to go through withdrawal as the Fed was withdrawing that cheap money. And Trump was like, no, I don't want withdrawal. Who's going to vote for me if they're, you know, everybody's hung up? I want to party again. I want the stock market at record highs. And so, you know, but so because we did this, we never actually had a real recovery. We just, you know, put more air into the bubble. But, you know, when COVID started, this is important to understand. So COVID-19 hits. And all of a sudden, you know, and I don't even know, I've seen some of your discussions on the podcast about COVID itself and whether or not the threat is being exaggerated. Is it really as big a health threat as a lot of people say? And, you know, I'm not an expert there. You know, I tend to always be suspicious of government, and I kind of think it's being exaggerated like most stuff. But I'm not a doctor. I'm not an immunologist. And so, I you know, let's just take them at their word that it's as bad as they say. And I just want to focus on the economics of it. But so when COVID hits and people, you know, people start, you know, staying home and they're not going out and, you know, and the people start losing their jobs and the economy starts tanking, right? The government comes in as if it's the government's job to rescue the economy. And the politicians say, in fact, Trump himself said, oh, we're at war. I'm a wartime president. This is like World War II. Remember that? Remember when he said that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's World War II. And we have to sacrifice. Americans have to sacrifice to beat COVID-19 the way, you know, a prior generation sacrificed to beat, you know, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan. We have to sacrifice. Except what we're doing now is the complete opposite of the actual sacrifice that Americans were asked to make during World War II, right? Apart from the fact that 16 million young men went off to war and risked their lives, apart from that sacrifice, the people that didn't go off to war, they actually sacrificed, right? So because 1941, when the war started, not even 10% of Americans paid any income tax at all. Fewer than 10%.
Really?
1942, there was a victory tax. And after the victory tax, more than a third of Americans began paying income taxes. They weren't paying any income taxes before the war. All of a sudden, they're paying income taxes. And in 1942, they created the withholding tax, which Americans, you know, we pay it today. You think it was always there. Up until 1942, nobody had any income taxes withheld from their pay. What happened was, if you were among the few people who actually paid income taxes, you didn't write a check until April 15th of the following year. You made no payments. You made no quarterly payments. You had no payroll withholding. That started as part of the victory tax. So massive tax increases on Americans. In addition to that, the U.S. government told Americans, we need more money than this. You need to loan us money. And so the Treasury started selling these war bonds to the public. And middle-class Americans bought the equivalent of trillions of dollars of war bonds. So the government taxed the middle class and borrowed from the middle class to pay for the war. And this is in 1940. We just went through the Great Depression. So these are Americans that just lived through a 10-year depression, the worst period in American history, yet they had enough money to loan trillions to the U.S. government and to pay much higher taxes than they were paying before. And in addition, nobody got a bailout. No businesses, if you ran a restaurant and nobody was coming to your restaurant because your customers were off fighting a war, and the ones that weren't fighting a war were now working harder to pay higher taxes, you know, and they people weren't taking vacations, they weren't going to theaters, they weren't staying in hotels, but none of these small business owners got one nickel from the U.S. government. The government didn't loan money to anybody, didn't bail anybody out. What are we doing now? The opposite. The government is cutting people's taxes.
Hold on a second. Hold on.
The government is loaning.
Hold on. Wasn't that but that's a different time, right? This is a time of a united country that is facing a global threat from a tyrannical German Nazi regime. It's a different situation than dealing with a virus. I mean,
Well, first of all, it's Trump and other people that made the comparison to World War II.
I understand
but
that.
This was a global threat. This was a real war. This was actually worse, believe
right.
me. COVID-19 is not as bad as having a world war.
Not even
right?
close.
I would much rather fight a disease than to fight Hitler. and Japan. I mean, this is not as bad as what people had to deal with in the 40s. Would you agree with that?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Okay. But the concept is the same. Government had to spend a lot of money fighting this war. And where did it get the money? It had to get it from the people, right? And yes. If people were, you know, disrupted, a lot of people lost money because of World War II. It wasn't their fault. If you ran a restaurant and now your customers weren't coming because they went to fight the war, it wasn't your fault that your business dried up.
Can I pause you for a second? Do you think that, first of all, we had to do something to stop the spread of COVID-19? Do you think?
I agree.
Yes.
I agree.
But hold on.
We didn't have to bail anybody out.
We have a problem.
We have to deal.
Peter, we have to deal with our issues. Peter,
you know,
we have a problem listening to each other. Let me explain it to the people that are listening. We're on Skype, and unfortunately, when you talk and I talk, we can't kind of hear each other. And you're not wearing headphones, so it's weird.
I got an earpiece.
Okay. But there's a little bit of a delay, so just let me. This is one of the reasons why I stress it's so much better to do these things in person.
Yes.
And I understand that it's impossible for you to do that right now. When you have a situation like COVID-19 and these medical experts say, hey, we've got to do something, we've got to shut down most of what we do. We've got to shut down a lot of businesses. We've got to shut down schools and make things remotely. There's going to be a situation where there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to be able to work, but we want to keep these businesses alive. This is a very unique situation, and this is not like any situation we've ever faced in my lifetime. What do you think could have been done that would have been a better solution than what the government did in terms of bailouts, in terms of telling people to stay home? Like, what could have been done?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to remember that the government doesn't have any money, right? The government only has money it takes from the people one way or another, right? Grover Cleveland, who is a president in the late 19th century, he was quoted, he had a good quote. He said, while the people must support the government should never support the people. And so I agree. Let's say we have to shut down the economy temporarily. Right? People should have enough savings to weather the storm. Businesses should have enough savings to weather the storm, like they did in 1940. Average Americans had lots of money in the bank. They weren't loaded up with debt. They didn't have credit card debt. They didn't have student loans. They didn't have car loans. They were solvent. Even after a Great Depression, they were solvent. We lived in a bubble economy. Everybody was paycheck to paycheck. Nobody had anything. Businesses couldn't survive if their revenue stopped. Workers couldn't pay their rent if they didn't get their salary. That's not right. That's part of the bubble, right? So the fact that we were so ill-prepared for a rainy day is because we had no rainy day fund.
Yes.
We should have been able to deal with this on our own, right? Now, we're not getting a freebie from the government. Peter, we're at now, we
basically locked down somewhere around March. We're 4.5 months in, or 4 months in now. That's a long rainy day. 4 months is a third of a year. There's very few human beings that have enough money to last 4 months. I'm sure you do, and I do, but most folks out there listening don't have enough money to live and feed their families and pay their mortgage or pay their rent and pay their car payments for 4 months. That's a long fucking time.
Right, but they're going to end up suffering much more in a year or two or three as a result of the massive inflation that has been unleashed to finance all the bailouts and the stimulus.
But don't you agree that it's a good idea to do something just to keep everyone alive, just to keep businesses alive, just to keep people in their homes, just to keep...
Well, first of all, a lot of the businesses should have failed even before. I mean, the Fed has been keeping a lot of businesses afloat that should have failed years ago.
But hold on, let's talk
about...
And
maybe COVID would have been the final nail in their coffins, and now they've got another lifeline. But these businesses are damaging the economy. See, businesses that are not profitable in a free market should shut down.
Okay,
right? Because they're squandering resources.
Can I pause you? Let's talk about my business. I'm in the business of comedy. Comedy clubs are suffering terribly right now because there's very few states that are allowing people to go out, wear masks, socially distance, and go to comedy clubs. LA is not allowing any of that, and they haven't since March. The Comedy Store, which is my home, has been shut down since March. All these clubs have been shut down all across the country through no fault of their own. It's not like these people.
I know that. It doesn't matter like that it's not their fault.
I understand that. But it's not like they've done anything wrong.
It's the state of California. If the state of California is going to order businesses shut down, and then the state of California wants to provide some kind of economic relief, let California do it. And let California impose higher taxes on whoever they think should fund it. We can't just use the Federal Reserve as a piggy bank. The Federal Reserve cure is going to do more damage than the coronavirus disease. And I think if the states knew that they would have to bear the economic consequences of their own decision making, they would do a better cost benefit analysis on what they shut down and how they do it. Right. Right now, every state is like, oh, let's shut everything down and the federal government's going to bail everybody out. So we don't care if we put people out of work because they're going to get these enhanced benefits from the U.S. government. Oh, we don't care if we shut down businesses because they're going to get these PPP grants from the government. But if the federal government let every state know, look, you make a decision. This, you handle this the way you want and you pay for it, right? So you do a cost benefit analysis, because thinking that everything is free, that is the problem.
I understand.
We are doing so much damage to the economy. People have no idea. We are going to get such a massive economic collapse, far worse than what I thought was coming, you know, when I did your show last few times. This is going to be much worse. We are compounding the mistakes of the past with much bigger mistakes. I mean, if you think it's bad now with the civil unrest, it's going to get a lot worse when there's no food.
I agree. Right?
When we run out of stuff.
Can I pause you?
Yeah.
Last time you were on, you were predicting the bubble of commercial real estate and a lot of other issues. What do you think is different about that situation now, and how much does that compound what we're dealing with currently?
Well, obviously, the coronavirus has made, you know, the problem worse for commercial real estate. I mean, yes. Commercial real estate is going to get killed for so many reasons.
It was devastating.
In trouble, I think, before COVID. But COVID, again, just accelerated the process. But obviously, if you are a retailer, you know, no one's coming into your store, your restaurant, if you got a gym, if you got a movie theater. So you're not collecting any rent. So you want to default. And so now your landlord's not getting paid. And he might have a mortgage. And now he can't pay because he's not getting rent. You've got all these office buildings where a lot of offices now, like my company, almost all my people are working from home now. I mean, I got some people that come into the office, but I got a lot of people working from home. And so a lot of companies are thinking, hey, I don't need all this commercial space. I don't need as big an office anymore because more of my people are working from home. So now you have pressure on the rent. So that was already happening. You know, you had WeWork that blew up and they had rented all this space that was now, you know, on the market for sublease. But all this was inflated by the Fed. Keeping interest rates artificially low to prop up these bubbles made that real estate bubble very, very big. And so now it's going to be far more disruptive when it pops. But it's got to pop. You know, trying to prevent bubbles from deflating by trying to blow more air into them just makes it worse. Maybe you delay the day of reckoning a little bit, but you make the day of reckoning much worse because now you have additional mistakes that you need to reckon with.
I understand. So it's essentially like a pull off the Band-Aid situation. And we have to have a healing moment. You have to let things collapse that need to collapse, that should have been done a long time ago because of mismanagement.
Yeah, and you have to understand that we're ripping the Band-Aid off a wound that the government inflicted us with in the first place.
Yes.
The free market never would have screwed us up this much. It was government interference in the free market. That's why, you know, capitalism gets a bad name. You know, that's why, you know, we talked about on one of these earlier podcasts about when I went to Occupy Wall Street years ago and I went down to Zuccotti Park, because you had all these young protesters who were blaming Wall Street for the bailouts and for the financial crisis. And I was saying, no, it's not Wall Street that took the bailouts. Blame the government for providing the bailouts, for making them available. Blame the Federal Reserve for funding all this and inflating the bubble.
Yes.
But, you know, the interesting thing, if I tried to do that today, if I tried to go to one of these protests, one of these Black Lives Matter protests or any of these, You think they'd be civil? You think I could do that? You think I could walk into a crowd of hundreds of people and take the opposite position and walk out of there?
They would beat you to death. Unscathed? They would beat you to death. 100%.
Yeah, so I mean, that's, it really shows you the loss of civility in just, 10 years.
Well, it's not just a loss of civility, it's a loss of opportunity and the loss of a faith in the system and the future if we stay on the same path. That's part of the problem. It's people don't believe that if we keep going the way we're going, that things will work out in an equitable, fair, and balanced way. And that's where people today...
The important point I wanted to make, though, too, when I went back to America in 1940, was to show that the American middle class, was real strong. They could afford to pay for World War II and to provide for their own families, because now they keep comparing World War II now, because we're running up as much debt now as we ran up during World War II. But we had the capacity to pay it back then. That was the point. The debt went way down. Debt to GDP went way down in the decades after World War II because Americans had the capacity to pay back what they borrowed to fight the war. We don't have that capacity now. I mean, the debt's never going to go down. The debt's going to keep on rising and rising and rising until the dollar implodes. See, that is the real crisis that we're headed for. It's going to be a collapse in the value of the dollar because right now we're printing money, right? And the government is sending it out and people are able to buy stuff with it, right? But that's going to come to an end because the world is no longer going to accept U.S. dollars as the reserve currency. See, that's the unique privilege that we've enjoyed for several generations now and that we've abused to the point where we're going to lose it. See, right now, we're able to print money and we use that money we print to buy all sorts of stuff that the rest of the world produces that we didn't have to produce ourselves. But producing goods requires capital, it requires labor, it requires land, it requires real resources. But we get all the stuff for free. We just create money and here you go, and they send us stuff. And then, to make it even better for us, they take the money that we send them, the paper, and they loan it right back to us at very low rates of interest. They buy our bonds, they buy our mortgage-backed securities. So Americans get to spend all this borrowed money that they didn't save. We get to consume all this stuff that we didn't produce. And so we have an artificially elevated standard of living. We live beyond our means. That's going to come to an end because foreigners are going to realize that we're never going to stop printing money, that the deficits are never going to be brought under control, that we're going to have QE infinity, 0% interest rates in perpetuity. And then they're not going to want the dollar anymore. And then the dollar is going to crash and we're not going to be able to import anything anymore. And the only things we're going to be able to buy is the stuff we make ourselves, except we don't make much stuff anymore. So prices are going to go through the roof. That is the real economic consequences. And so it's not going to matter that the government sends you a stimulus check if you can't buy anything with it, because the government can't create purchasing power. They can print all the money they want, but none of that printed money adds any purchasing power. They don't grow any food. They don't produce any products, nothing. They just print money.
Right, but there is, if the government gives money to people, they will be able to buy things, and people still are making things.
But when the dollar's value collapses, see, you can't keep printing trillions and trillions of dollars and expect the dollars not to lose purchasing power.
Right.
Right. Because paper money, all that does is that allows us to divvy up what we produce. Right. You have all these Americans now who used to be working, doing something. Right. They were helping to produce a product. They were providing a service, and now they're just at home collecting a check.
Right.
So they're getting money for nothing. They didn't put anything into the pot.
Can I
pause
you?
But now they want to take out of the pot with their money. Well, there's nothing in the pot.
Right.
So now the prices of everything in that pot have to go up because there's no extra stuff. There's just more buying.
Peter, as an economic expert, what would you have done differently if you could have advised this government? And we were, let's go back to March when everything was shutting down. What would you have advised differently?
Again, first of all, I would allow the states to be responsible for their own policy. So you decide what you want to do in your own state as far as, what businesses you want to close, what you want to do, and you pay for it. And if you think that certain businesses or individuals need to get money, then the state will provide it based on local taxpayers. But what I would have done on the federal level is I would have dramatically cut government spending. even after COVID-19, because government spending is a drain on the private sector. It's a drag on the economy. It's the government taking resources away from the private sector where they would be used efficiently and squander them in the public sector.
I understand. So can I pause you for a second?
It's
there?
A burden.
Can I pause you?
I would have lightened the burden.
What would you have? When you say lighten the burden, what would you have cut, and how would you do that? When you think about all the different aspects of the government that are essential, things that need to be in place, what would you have cut?
Well, most of the government money is transfer payments, where the government takes money from one person and gives it to somebody else. I mean, the government shouldn't be doing that. That's not why we have a government in America. Government is here to secure our
rights.
Can
you explain that?
To protect our property, not steal it.
Can you explain that? What do you mean by transfer payments?
Well, that's when the government takes money from one person through taxation and just hands it to somebody else, or now through inflation. The government just prints money and gives it to people that it thinks needs it.
But what do you
That's not what government. But let's look at the PPP.
Okay.
Right? Let's look at that, or the CARES Act, right?
Okay.
Look at all the damage that the CARES Act did to the economy. So first of all, let's look at the payroll protection plan that everybody wants to brag about, right? What a complete fraud this was. I said from day one, this would be a cesspool of fraud. You know, we found out last week that there were 600 approximately hedge funds, private equity funds, asset management companies that got PPP loans. And they're not even loans because you don't have to pay them back. So it's free money, right? And I could have gotten one of those loans if I wanted to. I just didn't want to lie to qualify.
Can you stop
but
right
apparently,
there? Can you stop right
600
there?
600 firms did.
Can you stop right there? Most people don't know that these hedge funds got this money. Most people think this money went out to American businesses to keep these businesses from collapsing because we need restaurants, we need, you know, movie theaters and all these various American businesses that we assume this money went to prevent from collapsing. Explain that, please.
Yeah, well, you didn't have to. All you had to do is apply. And according to the Small Business Administration, as long as the money you asked for was less than $2 million, they didn't ask any question. Because in theory, you were supposed to need the money, right? You were supposed to have some disruption. Like if you ran a restaurant and your restaurant is shut down, you don't have any revenue. There's nobody eating in your restaurant. So you have no money coming in. So how do you pay your waiters? How do you pay your busboys? You have no money. So the government was like, oh, we'll give you some money. As long as you don't fire your workers, we'll give you some money to pay your workers. But a company like mine, right, and I have two or three companies that I could have taken money from, and I didn't. But you look at my asset management company, Euro Pacific Asset Management. I'm making more money now than I was before COVID. And I assume
that's
the case with most firms that are in my industry.
Can you explain how that's possible?
Because our revenue was never shut down.
How is that possible? How are you making more money?
Because all I do is charge fees to manage people's money. I didn't stop managing their money because of COVID. I mean, we just keep on managing it and we keep on billing for our fees. We bill every quarter. We weren't even shut down. Even in Puerto Rico, where they were shutting down everything, I mean, I was considered an essential business, financial services. So, I people can come to my office, even though I let a lot of them work from home. And remember, all of our customers, they talk to us on the phone. So when I want to talk to a customer, the customer doesn't drive down to my office. You know, they just call me on the phone. And so there's no physical contact. So there isn't any disruption. All of the revenues that the hedge funds were getting, that the asset management companies, all that revenue continued unabated. Not a single job was in jeopardy, right? All these companies that got government money. See, the government wants to pretend that these loans saved jobs. They didn't save these jobs. These jobs were never in jeopardy of being lost. So all that happened is that it's a windfall. The asset management companies, the hedge funds, they got extra money from the government to make their profits even bigger, on top of the fact that the Federal Reserve printed all this money, which inflated asset prices. We charge fees on those assets. And so as the Fed inflates assets, Wall Street has inflated fees. We make more money. It was a double bailout for a lot of these Wall Street firms. So that was one of the frauds. But even in the case where the government is actually giving money to companies that need it, right, that otherwise would have fired their workers. Look, we don't know, you know, what the future demand for restaurants and bars and theaters is going to be. I personally believe that demand is going to be diminished for a long time. It's not just a temporary thing. I don't think it's going to come back to the way it was. especially since the way it was a bubble. See, that's what people don't get. They say, we want to go back to the way it was before COVID. We can't reflate that bubble. We have to start spending less. We have to save more. And that means we can't go out as often. We need to build up our savings again because we've depleted it. So there's going to be less demand for restaurants. There's going to be less demand for a lot of things. We have to let these companies downsize. Look at the airlines. Americans are going to be flying less. There's no question in my mind that domestic air travel is going to be down for many, many years, even after COVID is cured. So the airlines have to shrink. They have to lay people off. They have to be profitable. They have to, you know, effectively utilize resources. So to the extent that the government prevents businesses from laying off workers that really should be laid off, they ultimately compromise the viability of those businesses. And in the long run, they may end up putting people out of business that would have stayed in business. Maybe they, you know, maybe somebody had 100 employees and maybe they could have downsized to 30 employees and at least those 30 employees would have a job. But instead, they keep those employees on the payroll for long enough to the point where the whole company has to go out of business. And now everybody loses their job.
Now, when you say hedge funds were able to receive PPE and you're saying that they did so while they were still earning profits and there wasn't any diminishment of their income, why were they able to receive PPP?
Well, that's the problem with government programs. There's always fraud. Look, whenever the government is giving out free money, people try to qualify for it. Now, you know, you can read the fine print, and I know a lot of other people could say, hey, you know, Peter, it said as long as your business was affected by COVID. And look, yes, my business was affected. I mean, people worked at home that used to work in the office. But you had to basically testify or certify that the money was necessary to support the ongoing operations of your business, which for most of these firms, it wasn't. And you also had to say that you had no other source of capital, which, again, people were lying. But the government basically said, if you ask for less than $2 million, we're going to look the other way. We're not going to vet these loans.
But hold on, hold on. Did they actually say that?
They're non-recourse. There's no collateral. So a lot of businesses that were going to fail anyway and that were going to lay off all their workers took the money. They're still going to lay off all their workers, but now they're not going to have to pay the money back because they're going to bankrupt their business. And once your business is bankrupt, even though you fire all your workers, you're under no obligation to repay the loan.
Okay, did they actually say that if you ask for less than $2 million, we're going to look the other way? Like, where are you taking
that's
this from?
What it says is, we'll assume that you're filing an honest claim, right? Because they're saying that if you ask for more than $2 million, we're going to vet the claim and we're going to take a look at your situation. But it said on the Small Business Administration that we'll just assume you're being honest, right? So if you ask for less than $2 million, we'll assume you're being honest. Well, the minute they say that, oh, shit, I'm going to lie. That's the problem. So many people lie. Whenever the government has a program, it gets abused. That's part of the problem with government spending, right? Everybody tries to qualify. Like, just like the unemployment benefits, this crazy deal with the enhanced unemployment benefits. You have a lot of people now who are being paid twice as much not to work as they were earning when they were working. Now, you create that kind of incentive. You have a lot of people now, the last thing they want is to go back to work because they're making so much more money not working than they were when they were working. And most of these people, if you have a job where you're making, you know, $10, $15 an hour, $20 an hour, chances are you don't love your job. I mean, you're not working because you enjoy what you're doing. You're working because you need the money. You need to pay the bills. Well, if you can make the same amount of money or more without working, I mean, who's not going to go for that? I mean, I don't blame anybody for not wanting to work if the government is paying you more not to work than what your boss was paying you to work. And of course, you know, there's more than just working. You have to get up early in the morning. You got to fight traffic. You know, you got other expenses. Maybe you got to, you know, put your kids in daycare. You know, you got to, you know, launder, you know, dry clean your clothes. Women can spend an hour in the morning doing their hair, doing makeup. They don't get paid for that, but they got to do all that, you know, and add all that to commute time. I mean, so there's a big cost of working. And then, of course, you give up all your leisure. When you're at work, you can't have fun. The government now has created a situation where people are getting paid to have fun. So, I mean, How do you end that? What politician is now going to take this away?
I understand what you're saying about that, and I do agree with that, and that was very shocking to me that people that I know who have friends that are on unemployment don't want the economy to reopen because they would lose money. And I was like, my God,
look, I know
what
people
a conundrum.
That can't hire people.
But
you can't get people
on,
to work.
Please. Hold on,
why
please.
Why should you work?
Hold,
I get more
on.
Money not working.
Hold
so you
on.
Know what some
hold,
people do?
Peter,
they
Peter,
work under
Peter,
the table.
Peter, hold
they
on,
get
please.
Cash.
Jesus
they want
Christ.
To pretend they're unemployed
Peter.
So they can keep getting those benefits, and then they take a job under the table for cash.
Hold on,
that's
please.
What's going on.
I believe that. But that doesn't make sense with hedge funds. With hedge funds, if you're talking, we're talking about small businesses. Does a hedge fund qualify as a small business? And we're talking
well,
about them
remember,
receiving PPP, and as long as it's under $2 million, there's no questions asked. If they can't demonstrate a loss of income, how are they receiving this money, and what should have been done differently?
Look, I as soon as I heard about the program, I went online and I got the application just to see what it was. You don't have to prove anything. All you have to do is you have to have fewer than 500 employees, which is pretty much everybody. I mean, most of us in this business don't have 500 employees. And then what you did is you just listed your payroll, right? And they gave you 3 months of your payroll. So whatever you pay all your workers, right? And it was capped. So if you had some people that were making $1 million a year, they wouldn't cover the whole thing, right? It was like, I forget what the limit was, maybe 100 grand a year or something like that. But what they did is you could take all of your payroll for all your employees and then take 3 months worth of it. And the government said, we will give you a loan, no questions asked, for 3 months of your payroll. And as long as you don't fire more than a certain percentage of those people, you never have to pay the money back. So it didn't say anything about proving that you actually needed it, proving that, you know, that your revenue went down. So the government opened up an opportunity for all sorts of people. I mean, I could have had a few $100,000 if I wanted it. All I had to do is lie and claim I needed the money. But, you know, look, as much as I don't want the government to have money, and I'm already living in Puerto Rico, so I'm not paying taxes. So, I mean, people can say I'm a hypocrite because I'm living in Puerto Rico, but I'm not committing fraud. I'm being honest. Anybody that wants to pay less taxes is free to move to Puerto Rico. But I didn't want to commit fraud. I didn't want to sign a document and attest to the fact that I needed the money when I knew I didn't. And what business owner needs the money like that? I mean, if you're managing other people's money for a living and you can't handle, you know, a downturn in your business, then what business do you have managing people's money if you can't even manage your own?
I can't believe that anything under 500 employees is a small business. That seems like a like a regular business. Like what the fuck world are we living in where 500 employees or less is a small business? That seems like a business.
Yeah, well believe me, they're not like big corporations that have thousands and thousands. And there was other criteria like how many locations you can have. I can't remember all of it. But a lot of the people that applied were just self-employed people.
Yeah.
You know, so and so they were businesses of one. And so they got to, you know, they got their own a pay. But you didn't have to prove, because a lot of people's businesses were not disrupted. Because if you didn't work with the public in a public setting, right, if you just sat at a desk and worked on a computer and a telephone, you know, your business wasn't disrupted. So why do you need any government money?
Yeah. Kudos to you.
But the point is, even if you needed the money, the federal government shouldn't supply it by printing money. People don't realize how much damage we have done to this economy. The U.S. government, the Federal Reserve, is doing far more damage than COVID-19. That's what people don't get. We're gonna reap the whirlwind for what the government is sowing.
Well, kudos to you for not taking that money. I really appreciate that. Giving your understanding of what's legal and not legal, and the fact that you're willing to move all the way to Puerto Rico to avoid federal income taxes. Kudos to you.
I didn't only do it for the taxes.
I
did
know,
it for lifestyle and all that
kind
of stuff
there.
Too. I mean, the taxes make it affordable.
I understand.
But there are other reasons to live. I was going to move to Florida. I mean, you know, I was going to go down there, and so I ended up going to Puerto Rico.
Listen to me. Fuck Florida. Saw that shit off and sell it to the Russians. I'm happy that you didn't take that money. I really am. I want to understand what would have been the best maneuver if the federal government had, like, let's imagine that you and Trump were besties, and he's like, hey, Peter Schiff, what should I do? What should I do? We're going to have to do something. We have this COVID-19 situation. We're going to have to protect the citizens of the United States from this weird, novel coronavirus that we don't really totally understand at the moment, especially in February and March. We really didn't understand what the consequences of this virus were. What do you think they should have done differently?
Yeah. Well, again, first of all, we have to acknowledge how weak the economy was before COVID, right? That we didn't have a great economy, that the economy was a mess, that people were broke, right? Everybody was living paycheck to paycheck. Everybody was levered up.
Can I stop you there? Can I stop you there?
Yeah, but we have to recognize the fact that it was pouring out and we had nothing saved for a rainy day.
Yes.
So we need to acknowledge the fact, and we have to understand, why were we so broke?
Can I stop you?
Why was everybody so levered up in the first place?
Right. This is so frustrating to do these things with a delay. I'm so sorry. But when Trump talks about COVID, he talks about it being this interruption for this world's greatest economy, this thing that he had created during his administration. What's wrong with that narrative?
Well, I said that's a lie. You know, that's one of the things that frustrates me about Trump is pretending the economy was great, because somehow he thinks that because he's president, the economy should be great. I mean, that might be his own ego. Hey, I'm the president, so we must have a great economy. But we don't. It's the same economy he inherited from Obama, only more highly leveraged. And it's all the debt. It's all the corporate debt, all the individual debt, all the government debt. That's why we're so ill-prepared for any crisis, whether it's COVID-19 or anything else. We were broke before this happened. I said, it's raining out, and we've got no rainy day fund. So the first thing we have to acknowledge is, why was the economy so screwed up? How did it get screwed up? And that was because of the Fed keeping interest rates too low, discouraging people from saving, rewarding people from borrowing, putting too much emphasis on the stock market and not enough on the real economy, and government spending too much money. Government making us less productive by spending too much and regulating too much and subsidizing too much. So we screwed up the economy. So what we needed to recognize is, okay, we need to reverse all that, right? And yes, now we have an extra reason to do that because now we have COVID-19, but we need to restore sound money. We need to let interest rates go up. We need to let asset prices go down. And we have to build up our ability to deal with COVID-19. Instead, we're just printing even more money. We're juicing up the economy with even more debt. We're pushing up the NASDAQ to new highs. This is not productive. So, this is making the problem worse, that it dwarfs COVID-19. But I agree, because of all the mistakes of the past, because of all the bad monetary and fiscal policy, we were not prepared for this crisis. We weren't prepared for any crisis. Like, we couldn't fight World War II again like we fought in 1940. We're a shadow of our former self. We don't have the industrial might. We don't have the savings. So we don't have the tax base for the government to tap into to actually pay for a war. We just have a printing press. And we can only use that because foreigners are dumb enough to accept our money. And, you know, they're not going to be accepting it much longer. So this is bad news, right? Anyway, you shake it. America has a day of reckoning. And I would have rather had Trump level with the public and say, you know what? The day of reckoning is now. And yes, I know COVID-19 is bad, but we got a lot of other problems too. And we have to deal with it. We got to pay the piper, right? They were saying nobody has to suffer. Nobody has to sacrifice. You know what? We have to suffer. We have to sacrifice. I'm not happy about that, but it's better than the alternative, which is kicking the can down the road again so that we have to suffer even worse, which is that's the deal with the devil that we made. So we should have, you know, made government smaller. And look, maybe we should have dealt with the crisis more like Sweden. You know, I mean, a lot of people are giving shit to Sweden, but, you know, Sweden didn't want to make that bargain. They didn't want to print all this money. They bore their own costs. And so they had a different approach that didn't do as much economic damage. And, you know, our economy was so screwed up. I mean, the Swedish economy is in much better shape than ours. And not because they're socialists like Bernie Sanders thinks, because they're not. Because they're actually more capitalist than we are.
Sweden's more capitalist than we are?
Yeah. You know, the rich pay lower percentage of taxes in Sweden than we do. You know, they don't even have an inheritance tax. There's no estate tax in Sweden.
Really?
Zero. No, yeah.
I would have never guessed that.
Sweden became a very rich country because they were a capitalist country. And once they became very rich, they experimented with socialism, which was an unfortunate experiment because there's no reason to experiment with socialism because every time it's tried, it's failed. But they decided to try it, and of course it failed. And so they had to start rolling it back once they saw all the damage that the welfare state in Sweden was creating. So they started dialing it back, and they've gone a long way. They haven't eradicated it completely. But if you look at the tax proposals by Joe Biden, I mean, we're going to go so far above Sweden as far as the confiscatory levels of taxation. I mean, look what Joe Biden wants to do with the income tax, the corporate tax and the personal tax. He wants to raise the corporate tax from 21 to 28, but then he wants to raise the dividend tax from 24, where it is now, to about 40-something-ish. I forget the exact amount. But corporations are taxed twice, right? They're taxed when they earn the money and then when they distribute it to the owners. So you have to add up both rates. But then he also wants to apply Social Security taxes to those dividends, not just the Medicare taxes. So he basically wants to take the effective corporate tax rate up from about 40% where it is now to about 60%. That's where he wants it, which is a huge increase, or 70%. I forget the word. It's a massive number. And it really is fascism, because the government ends up owning all these businesses. Because if you take more than half of the income of a business, I mean, you basically own that business. I mean, it's your business. You're getting more than half the income.
Right.
So the government is really nationalizing these corporations
through
taxation. But it's not the corporations. It's the individual shareholder, right? They're the ones that own the business.
That's a very important way to look at it. The way you look at it there, where half of the income is going to someone else. And I wanted to stop you for a second, but I wanted to hear that rant. There's a connection that people make they connect socialism to empathy, socialism to kindness, socialism to people that are less greedy, socialism to people that are more interested in a community. This is coming from a person like myself who has no economic. 86% of what I know about the economic world is from you. So I'm an idiot, all right? I listen to people who are experts. But when I think of the idea of community and of helping people out, I think of the idea like what's wrong with some socialist policies. We have the fire department. That's a socialist policy. Nobody wants a fire department to be only for people who have money. We want the fire department to be for the community. It doesn't matter if you have $0. If your house is on fire, we're all going to pay for the fire department to come put it out. We all have a vested interest in keeping your house from burning down and you dying and the whole community from burning, right? We have these certain agreements.
There's a big difference between type of
Hold on a second. You're right. You're 100% right. But it's the idea behind it that comes from idealistic people. And I'm putting myself in this category. I am often naive and idealistic, but also ruthless in my assessment of human character. It's a big contradiction, because I think there's a lot of people that really could do more than they're doing, and they know they could, and they want to make excuses. And it's part of the reason why throughout history they've left people behind. There's certain people that if you had a tribe and you had to make it over this mountain, and Bob is fucking lazy and he's like, you got to carry me, bro. I'm like, Bob, we're both walking. Come on, man. Bob's not supposed to make it. He's not supposed to make it. We want him to make it, but we don't want our kids to die. We don't want our mom to starve. We got to keep going. Bob, you lazy fuck. Come on, bro. There's always been people like Bob, and it's part of the problem with humans. So I'm a contradiction. But hold on a second. That's what attracts people to socialist ideas. It's just that they're nice, that they want everybody to do better.
Socialist ideas are very appealing.
Yes.
I mean, I get that. And that's why they're very popular with young people who don't know any better. They don't have enough life experience.
But this is the bridge. Peter Schiff, this is the bridge, because a guy like you who really understands economics can talk to a guy like me and we can explain it to everybody. Because otherwise we just have, and I'm definitely not arguing with you, but your argument versus people who disagree with you's argument. You have this, but there's an opportunity to make this bridge and for us to understand each other.
That's what I'm hoping. That's why I'm here.
I listen to make that bridge.
And I appreciate that. I want to help people evolve from being socialist to being capitalist, because capitalists aren't mean.
Yes.
They just understand the unintended consequences of these well-intentioned programs that the left is in favor of, but they don't understand that they actually backfire and make all the problems that they're trying to solve worse.
And isn't part of the problem with labels?
Your fire department.
When
you have a local fire department, right? That fire department is there to put out any fire at any house, right? So everybody in the community benefits from having a fire department. It's not there just for one person. It's for everybody in the community. We're talking about where the government takes money specifically from one person and gives it to somebody else for their specific benefit because they think they need it for whatever problem, whatever reason they need the money.
Agreed. And this would be like Bob wanting money from you, our lazy friend Bob, we were talking about.
I am all in favor of private charity. I'm all in favor of people voluntarily helping out their fellow man. And Americans will do that. I mean, we did do that. We did that a lot more in the past when the government didn't take so much of our income in taxes. We had a lot more money. Like I mentioned Grover Cleveland, when he said that quote about the government not supporting the people, there was a bill to appropriate $10,000 for some farmers in Texas who had been hit by a drought. And Grover Cleveland vetoed the bill because he said, look, there's nothing in the Constitution that allows the government to give money to people just because they need it. I mean, this is not right. We can't take money from the taxpayers and just give it to somebody because we feel they're in need. And so he vetoed that bill. But after he vetoed it, the farmers got more than 10 times that amount of money in private donations from individual Americans who wanted to help out.
That's good.
Your own money at a charitable giving, that is great. That is noble.
Yes.
But when you steal money from somebody else and give that money, there's no nobility in that. That's theft. I don't care what you do with the money after you steal it. Stealing is wrong.
I see what you're saying. I like what you're saying. Is there an opportunity where these two things can merge, where people can realize, like, hey, we need less taxes and more charitable donations, and it's both possible, and you would probably save money, and we could figure out a way to distribute that money in an equitable way that you have control over. So if there's certain charities that you really feel strongly about, like cancer research.
The people who are likely to give the most to charity are wealthier people because they have more discretionary income. And if you have a lot of wealthy people who are paying 40-50% taxes, and I was doing that. I was paying about half of my money in taxes before I moved to Puerto Rico, right? I didn't have any special tax breaks. I paid about almost half my money in taxes. So because half the money went to the government, I had a lot less money that I could be charitable with, right? I mean, I had all the money I needed to take care of myself. The money that was taken away from me by government was money that I would have invested to help grow the economy, or maybe I could have used it in direct charitable giving. And the other benefit of when you allow more private sector charity, private sector charities are much more efficient because they really care about the people they're trying to help. Governments don't give a damn. When you have a government program, that program exists to benefit the bureaucracy of the program. So they squander the money. And the last thing they want to do is end poverty, because then there's no longer a need for their program. They want to perpetuate dependency. You know, if you go back to the Great Society in the 1960s, if you look at the declining poverty rates in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, you know, leading up to the 1960s when we had all the civil rights and all this big war on poverty, we were beating poverty. We were kicking poverty's butt. Poverty rates were really falling in this country until the government declared war on poverty. And then poverty won. That is the problem. The government created poverty. They didn't eliminate it.
Well, what should they have done differently?
They should have allowed free market capitalism to keep lifting people out of poverty. Look, the reason people are poor is because they're not earning enough money. Well, how do people earn more money? They become more productive. How do you get more productive? You acquire skills and you have capital. Your employer provides you with capital that makes your labor more productive. And because you're more productive, you can earn more money. And that lifts you out of poverty. So it's free market capitalism that lifts people out of poverty. And so the smaller the government is, the more capitalism we have. The more wealth we can create, the more employment opportunities we can create, Government just gets in the way.
Can I pause you for a second? So what you're saying is there's an opportunity to be compassionate without like the demand for you being compassionate by the federal government. And if people had to spend less money on the government, there's opportunities for them to donate more money to charities. And this would be like a better way of managing our money and our charity and all these things.
Yes, it's much more efficient, voluntary giving. Look, when people give money voluntarily, their own money, they don't want it to be squandered. They don't want it to be wasted. I mean, whenever you give the charities, you always look at the charity and you want to know, hey, if I give you $1,000, how much of it is used in bureaucracy and how much goes to the recipients? And
isn't
you can look
shocking?
At their books and you can say, hey, we're going to take 10 cents to run the charity and actually 90 cents is going to go to the people that we're trying to help.
Right, but isn't
with the
it
government, it's the other way around. They take in a dollar and only 10 cents actually goes to the people that need the money. The rest of it is absorbed in the bureaucracy. There's no incentive to be efficient. Charities have to be efficient or nobody will give them money.
Mm.
Government has no incentive to be efficient because they take your money. There's no voluntary interaction there. They take your money from you. And so they can be as inefficient as possible. But then the private charity wants to help people out so they no longer need the charity. The government wants to keep people impoverished so they're in constant need of the charity because that way they can get their vote. The government knows if they steal money from Peter and pay Paul, that they'll always get Paul's vote. And that's what they're concerned about. They want to keep people entrapped in poverty so that there'll be reliable votes.
Is that what they want, or do they just want to maintain this system that they have control over? Because if they just released everything to the public sector, like if they just release everything from policing to the water purification, to everything they do, if they just instead of the government handling everything, they just allowed it to the private sector, how would we manage whether or not they were doing the good of the people overall? Like, that's what everybody's worried about. What everybody's worried about is big business assuming this monopolistic, gigantic monolith that crushes everything before it and pollutes the rivers. That's what we're worried about. So the idea of the government stepping in for business is to keep business from only growing and not growing with concern for the consequences of all the other people around it. That's where everybody gets real suspicious, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, and they shouldn't be. And this is something that always kind of bothers me, that people just attribute sinister motives to private businessmen, yet they think politicians are angels and just there to do the Lord's work.
Right.
I mean, there's just as many greedy people who go into politics as who go into business. In fact, probably more. But there's a big difference. See, I have protection because if a greedy person goes into private business, his greed can only help me. Right, because the way a business grows and gets bigger is by selling more products and services. Well, why would I buy those products and services? I have to like them. I have to think they're better than the products or services that some other businesses is offering me. And I have to value those goods and services more than the money I'm voluntarily exchanging to get them.
Right.
So the beauty of the free market is that you have all these businesses who may be greedy competing with one another to best satisfy my desires, my needs, to make me happy. And if they don't make me happy, if they can't satisfy my disease, I don't buy their products.
Agreed.
So they have to win me over. They have to woo me and seduce me to get my business. So I don't have to be worried about a greedy businessman who wants to make money because he can only make money by making my life better. On the other hand, you take a greedy person and you give them the power of government, they can make my life miserable. They don't have to get me to voluntarily do anything. They just take my money by brute force and they just do to me whatever they want. So where you have to fear greed and power is when it's in government, where it can actually harm you.
Okay,
not in the private sector where it can help you. Now, I know someone's going to say, well, what if there's a criminal? What if somebody is stealing my money? Yes, they're violating the law and we need government to protect me from thieves, but businessmen that are honestly convincing me without fraud or deception, but are being honest and I'm buying their product, that, you know, their greed doesn't help me. Right? It doesn't hurt me. It only helps me.
I think we're in agreement on a lot of this, especially what you said, that we need government to protect people from a business getting out of control and demonizing people. But it doesn't mean that capitalism in and of itself is a demonic thing, a bad thing. It's a good thing.
No,
and you think you can
what
elevate
we're doing
things.
Now, but all the Wall Street bailouts, that's not capitalism, right?
Right.
The banks that were overleveraged in 2008 should have been allowed to fail. Investors should have lost money. None of this is capitalism. Bailing out companies that should fail is not capitalism.
Do you think it's corruption? Right? Do you think it's a crime? Like when you say it's not capitalism, then what is it?
Well, I mean, you can call it statism, a crony capitalism, fascism. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways you can describe it, corporatism, but it's not free enterprise. It's not capitalism. Failure is an important part of capitalism, right? Because if you look at the science of economics, what is economics about? It's about how do you satisfy unlimited human desires, unlimited demand with limited resources, right? We have scarce resources. They're not, you know, infinite. We have so much land, labor, capital. And so we have to figure out how to organize our resources in the way to satisfy as many demands as we can. And so businesses compete with each other for those resources. And the businesses that combine them in a way that they can generate a profit, that means that they're adding value. That means that the goods they're producing are more valuable than the resources they consumed in the process of producing them. So that's a good thing. But when businesses are taking resources and their products cannot recover the cost of production, they are squandering our resources. And those businesses need to fail so those resources can be freed up to be utilized more effectively by some other entrepreneur doing something else. So we need companies that can't generate a profit to go bankrupt. That the profit and loss is the thermometer that tells you if you're doing the right thing. If you're making a profit, keep doing it because you're creating value. If you're losing money, then stop. You're destroying value. Your business is making us poorer. So the market is trying to function so that we can have an optimal amount of economic growth. Then you have the government coming in and deciding to subsidize businesses that it doesn't want to fail, you know, because, oh, we might lose some votes. You see, there's a concept about the seen and the unseen. And politicians are concerned about what you can see, because when the politician bails out a company and they save the jobs of these workers, everybody can see that and they can take credit for the jobs they supposedly save. But what you don't see are the jobs that were never created or might have got destroyed because the government misdirected capital from where the market would have put it to where the government wants it. So we destroy productive jobs in order to save non-productive jobs. That makes us poor. But the politician takes credit for the good that he supposedly does, but he doesn't get any of the blame for the bad that nobody can actually attribute to his action.
Is it possible that there could be a cap on the amount of, like, we all agree that everyone, there needs to be some regulations, right, in terms of environmental impact and a bunch of different things that corporations can do wrong with regard to fucking over their workers or whatever they're doing wrong. There has to be some government. You can't just allow people to thrive and do whatever they want to do. You have to have some sort of regulations, right?
Well,
so who decides?
You can't violate people's rights. But give me an example. When you're saying there has to be some rules to protect workers from their employers, like what are you talking about there in particular?
Well, I mean, if you have a company that gets enormous, just absolutely enormous, and they control all the jobs in a region, they could really dictate how much money people get per hour, and they could make it really poor and terrible. And you could say that people have the right to just leave or find something else or create a better future. That is possible. I mean, they can do that. But if something controls an enormous
got
area,
really big, right?
Right.
Not because it had some special monopoly granted to it by the government, right? It didn't get a big government subsidy.
It was just commercially
effective.
The government
didn't have a law making it illegal to compete.
Right. Right.
If this company got so big in a free market, that meant it got really big because it was just providing the best services to its customers. But also, if it was able to employ that many people, it must have been offering those people a good deal. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken the job, right? Because businesses compete for two things.
That's not necessarily true. That's not necessarily true. Because if there was no other jobs available, if you live in a place...
No, but there would have been, right?
There
would have been some jobs originally. I mean, there's no way that there's just one business in the entire community.
But if you're born into this and you're 16 years old, you're shit out of luck. and that corporation does have control over you. If you're born into it, if you're 16 years old, okay, you're in high school and you're getting your first job, and the only job is at Walmart, you're working at Walmart. If that's all you have, you know, it's
well, assuming Walmart is the only potential employer. Now, I would say that that's not going to be the case.
It's usually not the case.
That you're not getting a job when you're 16 is probably because the minimum wage is making you unemployable. And we can get into that discussion because I'd like to talk about minimum wage. But first, let's talk about how businesses compete for workers, just like they compete for customers, right? Because I have three businesses. I hire people, right? And I just can't pay my workers, you know, a tiny wage because they're not going to work for me.
But don't you agree there should be a minimum wage
that are in demand? There's plenty of people that are bidding against me for those same workers.
Right.
And so I have to pay the market rate. I can't just underpay them. They'll go work someplace else.
I understand. But do you think there should be a minimum wage?
No, there should be zero minimum wage.
Wow. That's interesting.
And we've discussed that before.
I know.
But
I still
the reason that I don't think there should be a minimum wage is because I think individuals should be free to accept employment opportunities that they want to accept. See, the minimum wage doesn't hurt businesses. It hurts individuals that have low skills, right? And that's always the problem. When you have people defending the minimum wage, or opposing minimum wage hikes, they always say, oh, it's going to hurt businesses because, you know, it's going to increase their labor costs. You know what? It doesn't necessarily increase their labor costs because they don't hire as many workers.
Right.
They hire skilled workers instead of unskilled workers. They automate. They find ways to do without workers. They outsource. They hire people in other countries. The minimum wage law hurts the most low-skilled people, and they tend to be young people, teenagers, minorities. That's who get hit the hardest. You know, before we had all these programs, you know, the black teenage unemployment rate once upon a time was actually lower than the white teenage unemployment rate. Now it's like double or triple as high. But before we had all these laws, it was actually lower because they got disproportionately impacted by the minimum wage law, which prices them out of work. I mean,
When were these laws implemented?
Well, the minimum wage didn't really start until the Great Depression, right? So it started, but it didn't apply to, there were a lot of jobs that it were exempted from it. So it really started kicking in more in the 1960s. And then it really, you know, started
playing
a role.
Has anybody ever tried to have no minimum wage as an experiment, like maybe a town or a city?
Well, first of all, we had no minimum wage before it was implemented. And we had much lower rates of unemployment, real unemployment.
But
you look
at
countries that don't have the minimum wage, there's not that many left anymore. I mean, most countries have made this mistake because the minimum wage is good politics because it sounds good, right? If you're for the minimum wage, it sounds like you care, right? Is anybody against, you know, people working for low wages? No, okay, so it sounds good.
Right.
But all you do is you destroy jobs and you destroy employment opportunities. But there are countries like Singapore, for an example, has no minimum wage, you know.
But wait a minute, don't they cane you? Singapore, don't they cane you if you graffiti shit? Right?
That's I know they frown at that on that over there.
That was a famous place.
Talking about that.
We're talking about minimum wage.
I mean, Switzerland doesn't really have, I mean, there's other countries that have some kind of weird minimum, but it's not the same as ours.
I feel like there could be a minimum wage and we still hold the same values that you're talking about in terms of competition to keep people from getting fucking shitty with their employees. Have you ever seen an employer like yell at their employees or like be in like one of those corporate gathering situations where someone has a lot of control over their employees? Now imagine if that guy was making all the money and he was only giving these employees $1 an hour and making them live in poverty.
But it's not slavery.
I agree with you, most likely they would quit.
If you like it, if you think it's the best alternative. Look, people quit all the time because they can get a better job.
Right.
So by definition, if the best job I can get is the job I have and nobody will offer to pay me more money, then I'm not underpaid. If nobody will pay me more, it's a free open market. There's all kinds of employers out there. And remember, you're free to work for yourself. Nobody forces anybody to accept a job. Everybody can start their own business. Everybody can be self-employed, right? So if you don't think your boss is paying you what you're worth, then quit and start your own business.
I feel right? I completely feel where you're coming from, but couldn't we just say that there's a level of paying? If you make someone work 40 hours a week and they don't have enough money for food or shelter after 40 hours a week, couldn't we say that maybe that is not a good level? Like, let's just, as a community, so everybody agrees we're all competing, but let's make it so that if someone is under your employment and it's a human being and they're doing 40 hours of work every week, they should have enough money for food and shelter. That seems reasonable. Well, as a community, I know what you're saying in terms. I know what you're saying from like this economic standpoint. I know what you're saying. Like, let you, free market capitalism, let it ride. Figure it out. Get paid what you're worth. And if you don't feel like you're getting paid enough, quit. I understand what you're saying, but wouldn't it be nice?
Let's backtrack then.
Okay.
So
go ahead.
In general, right? If you don't have any skills, right? If the most you're able to earn at your job, and let's say there's no minimum wage and you're just a young kid and you don't have any skills,
right?
And the most you can earn is $4 an hour. That's because, again, it's you're paid based on your productivity. Businesses are there to make a profit for the owner of the business because that businessman is taking a lot of risk. He's bearing the potential for losing money.
Of course.
He has to provide, you know, and so a businessman is not going to hire somebody if they're not adding value to the business. So if somebody can add $5 of value to my business, I'm not going to pay them $7.25 an hour because I'm going to lose $2.25 for every hour that person works. So the only way I can hire somebody who is providing $5 worth of value is if I can pay him $4. Right? Then I can make a dollar for every hour he works. The business is not there to lose money. They're there to make money. So let's say you're a young kid and you can only provide $5 worth of value. And so you get a job for $4 and your employer makes a buck an hour off of you. Chances are you don't have a family. You're young. You're living with your parents. You don't have rent. You don't have, you know, so making a little bit of money is okay. You just need some spending money to go to a movies or maybe go out on a date or something. You don't need a lot of money. What's important is the work experience, having that job, developing some skills, getting your foot in the door. Step on that first ladder of the job, the rung of the job ladder, so that by the time you're 30 and you're ready to settle down and get married and have kids, you've now increased your skills to the point that you can make $50 an hour where you can afford to support a family. If you try to tell a business that you need to pay somebody who has no skills and adds minimal economic value, if you have to pay that person enough so that you can support a family, nobody's going to hire that person. All you're doing is pricing those people out of a job. So it's really good to say it's not right if somebody is working and only making, you know, $10 an hour and they can't support a family. It's not the employer's responsibility. It's not his fault that he's hiring somebody that doesn't have a lot of skills. And if you impose that minimum wage, all you're doing is making it impossible for this guy to get a job. It really, what the minimum wage law is it makes it illegal for you to work unless you have enough, a certain amount of productivity. So if the minimum wage is $15 an hour, what that means is if you only have $10 an hour work of productivity, right, you can't work, that you have to turn down every offer of employment you get. If someone offers you $10, $12, that's illegal. You can't accept those jobs, even if you want them, even if you think that that's the beginning of the first step on a road to higher wages in the future. The government says, no, you can't accept that. Unless you can find somebody who will pay you $15 an hour, it is illegal for you to have a job. And that is not good economic policy. That is, and it's not even compassionate, because now you've taken away all the honest ways that somebody can make a living, and they end up turning to crime a lot of times.
I see what you're saying, and that actually makes a lot more sense the way you're framing it, about like if you only provide $10 worth of value to the company, why should they pay you $15? And
they
you know,
won't.
I agree with you. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. You're making me think about it in a different way for sure. I think a lot of people would say, well, if they're really only providing $10 worth of value, do you really need that person? Should you be more streamlined?
I mean, $10 worth of value is still value.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I mean, look, think of all these. Look, I get very frustrated all the time, you know, when I make phone calls and I can't talk to a human being. I have to talk to a computer.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is because we've priced the human beings out of the market.
Well, you know what else is interesting, Peter? What's horrible about this for all of us is when you do that, and you know you're dealing with these goddamn computers. It's like we're losing part of our connection when it comes to doing business. We're doing. I like if I do business with a company, I like to be able to call them up. I like to. There's. Yeah. I'd love it if there's a thing when I'm doing something. I like to make contact with the person. If everything is being done through automated systems, it's getting weirder and weirder for us. More and more detached. Look,
do you remember the original Back to the Future movie?
Yes.
Remember when he goes back to 1955 for the first time and he sees that car pull into a gas station and like five people descend on the car and start washing the windows,
yeah.
checking the tires, doing all that stuff, right? What happened to all those people, right? Because that's what gas stations were like
sort of
before the minimum wage destroyed all those jobs.
I worked in a gas station. Yeah. Did you ever work in a gas station?
I never did, but I delivered groceries. I delivered pizza. I worked in a shoe store. I had all kinds of jobs in high school. That, you know, the probably kids don't have those opportunities today. They just they can't get it. But going back to the gas station, right? Do you like pumping your own gas?
I do because I used to work at a gas station and I know what happens when you let kids pump your fucking gas. I don't want anybody they spill it. They fuck up. There's some weirdo has got a highly flammable fluid next to a piece of your property and they get to stick it in there.
I think if we didn't have a minimum wage, you'd have a lot more kids working mostly for tips. I mean, we used to tip. If you remember, I'm still old enough to remember tipping the guy that pumped my gas.
Yes, they check your tires, the whole deal.
But you know what used to happen? These young kids that got low-paying jobs as pump jockeys, what they would do between fill-ups is they would go and hang out with the mechanic who was there working on cars, and they would get a free education in auto mechanics. And they would actually learn a trade.
Have you ever seen
some of these guys? I mean, we'd have more auto mechanics that get a skill. Some of these guys would end up, you know, opening up their own service stations. Look, it's good to allow young people to have employment opportunities, not to price them out of the market by mandating a minimum wage. I mean, the minimum wage benefits high skilled workers, unions, by eliminating competition with younger, you know, lower skilled workers. You're forcing employers to hire high skilled people instead of a more numerous number of lower skilled people. That's what happened.
Have you ever seen the movie The Hustler with Paul Newman, Jackie Gleason?
Yeah, it's a great movie. In fact, I saw the remake with what's his name?
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, yeah, and also with Paul Newman.
But my point is
they're both good movies.
They're great movies. But in the beginning of The Hustler, Paul Newman pulls into a gas station. And he tells the guy, check the air and tires, check the oil, do all this. And the guy, fill them up, mister. They go out there and they have like, they do all kinds of shit for you. It's not just as simple as they pump your gas. They pump your gas, check your tires, check your fluids. They do everything. But there was less people with cars back then, too. Yeah, and that kept
the cars. Cars were in better shape because, you know, every time you went into a gas station, somebody made sure you had enough oil. They made sure your tire pressure was good.
Well, cars are more reliable today. Those cars were bullshit. Those cars, like, you had to check the air. You had to check the tires. It was bleeding oil. But it's just interesting to see the difference.
Well, they used to have ushers in movie theaters.
Yep, I remember that.
They would just show you to your seat. The service sector has really been obliterated. All these low skilled, look, they're working on these kiosks now. Look, they're going to get rid of all the workers anyway. Ultimately, all these fast food restaurants, there's not going to be anybody there. They're all going to look like self-serve gas stations.
Yeah.
You're going to go in, you're going to order off your smartphone, and the food is going to, you know, come down a chute through some machine. There's going to be nobody there.
I worried we're going to lose movie theaters. I really worry about that. Movie theaters, that we're going to lose movie theaters?
Well, we lost drive-ins.
Yeah.
You know, some of them are coming back, but once upon a time,
they're
had all these drive-ins.
They're coming back now because of COVID. People love them now. It's a great idea. It's a great way to be socially distant and still watch a movie with a bunch of other people.
Yeah. But look, things evolve. I mean, people have giant screen TVs now. They don't cost a lot of money. That's the beauty of capitalism. I remember the first, high def TV I ever saw. I went into a department store, or not department, like a Good Guys, one of those electronic stores. And I remember looking at it. I was amazed because I was like, oh, this is like looking through a window. It was like, because people don't realize how bad the pictures used to be unless you actually see an old TV, you know, one of these with the tubes compared to what we look at now. I mean, you can't even watch one of those things. But, you know, we didn't know how bad it was until something better came along. But when I first saw that, I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. But I didn't buy it because it was $10,000. And that was a lot of money to me back then when I was in my 20s. A $10,000 TV, I could buy a car for that. I wasn't going to spend that much money on a TV. Now you get those TVs for $500-$600.
Yeah, it's
and they're
crazy.
Internet enabled, and they're, you know, they're smart. They do all this stuff. But so now, you know, people don't need to go to the theater as often because they have good quality at home. They've got all kinds of streaming services they can see. And so if we're evolving to the point where more people are chilling at home with Netflix, then the theaters have to evolve. I mean, and you know what? So we can use those resources. We can do other things. I mean, businesses have to find other ways to make me spend my hard-earned money at their establishment. You know, but by the way, that the example of a television set, because you hear this all the time. I mean, it's a little bit of a tangent, but it's an important topic. You know, so the reason that I didn't buy that $10,000 TV, it wasn't because I didn't want it. Is because I couldn't afford it, right? But some people were rich enough to afford it, and they bought those TVs. And because some rich people bought those $10,000 TVs, the companies that made them got money so that they can figure out how to make them cheaper. And then the price came down to $5,000, and then more people bought them. And as more people bought them, the companies got bigger, and they invested in R&D, and they found out how to make them better and cheaper. And so the free market reduces prices. And when prices go down, we buy more stuff. But now you have all these politicians trying to sell us a bill of goods that we need inflation, that the Federal Reserve has to make sure that prices go up every year. Because if prices don't go up, they say we won't buy anything. We're all going to sit back and wait for lower prices, which is a bunch of nonsense. People buy televisions, they buy computers, they buy cell phones. They know that if they wait a year or two, they'll be cheaper, but they don't wait. Because the only time you wait to buy something is if you can't afford it. And then you wait until you can afford it. You know, the first cell phone, you ever watch the movie Wall Street?
Yes, I talk about that scene all the time, him walking on the beach with that brick.
Yeah, money never sleeps. Those cell phones were like, I don't know, $5,000.
Yeah.
Back then. And if you made a phone call, it was like a dollar every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I remember my first cell phone. I would have to get off the phone so quickly because I didn't want to spend the money.
What year
did
you have
it? And I would call people. I would wait till the evening or the weekends to make the calls because it was too expensive to make the call, you know, during the day.
I remember those days. Roaming. Remember roaming?
Yeah, you get charged.
Crazy money.
I mean, you got charged extra. Long distance. I mean, it used to cost a lot of money to dial long distance.
Yeah, that's a good example.
I mean, there's no such thing. I can call somebody in Asia, you know, on WhatsApp, and it's free, and I can see them.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This is the beauty of capitalism.
Yeah.
The free market brought the prices down, and now more people own these products. So the government is trying to tell us that we need rising prices. We don't. Businesses make more money when prices go down. Because when prices go down, their costs go down. And what's important is not the price, but the margin, the difference between your cost and your price. And the lower the price, the more customers you have. And if you sell more units, you make more money. So this is all nonsense. But that's the beauty of capitalism. It makes things cheaper and better. Government makes things worse and more expensive, right? Every service that the government provides you with, whether it's education or healthcare, it gets more expensive. And the quality goes down. Everything we get from private sector gets cheaper and the quality goes up. That's why we want to limit what government does to the smallest amount of stuff and let the free market do everything else because it's going to do it better.
I see what you're saying, and it sounds beautiful if it was that simple. Do you think it's really possible to manage this whole country that way? Really? Genuinely?
Well,
we have some regulation,
you know, democracy
just to keep
gets
from
in the
being
way.
A complete asshole?
Right? Because you have these politicians that want to get votes.
Right.
And the way they get votes is they promise to steal something from one person and give it to the person who votes for them. That's the problem. And then in order to stay in power, right, governments basically take what amounts to bribes from businesses to basically protect them from competition or bail them out. We've given the government too much power. And you can't blame the private sector for trying to get that power to be used in its advantage, because if it doesn't do that, one of its competitors will get it and it'll be used against. Like, the government is like the mafia, right? And people have to pay protection money for the government to leave them alone and to kind of set them against somebody else. You know, there's a great movie. I might as well plug it because the sequel is coming out. But the guys that produced it, they did a really good job. It's the Bubble movie, right? And if you go to letusdisagree.com, you can see this movie. But the guy that produced it, Jimmy Morrison, and, you know, I remember he came to my office and filmed me. He started it back in like 2010 or something because he wanted to talk to the people that predicted the 2008 financial crisis and get their perspective on what the government did wrong. And so this is a whole movie about the history of how government has screwed stuff up. The way back to, you know, the Great Depression, because there's, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there about why we had the Depression. People say, oh, it's because we had too much capitalism. It's not. It's because we had too much government. We had a Depression in 1920 that nobody knows about because it ended so quickly because the government did nothing. The reason we had a Great Depression in the 30s was because Herbert Hoover did the same type of stuff that Trump is doing. Herbert Hoover was the first big interventionist president that started spending money to prime the pump to try to make it better. Hey, we can't just sit back and allow people to lose their jobs. And so Hoover intervened in the economy and helped create the Great Depression. And then Roosevelt came in and just expanded on Hoover's failed programs. And the Great Depression spanned the entire decade of the 1930s. We didn't get out of the Depression until 1945 when we ended the Second World War. And government finally started to get smaller. But this movie goes all the way back to that, and then it goes to the housing bubble. And so it's a great movie to really show how the government creates these problems with well-intentioned programs. And the sequel is about to come out, which is about the next crash, which is the one that's coming, right? And that it's coming soon. And because of what we just did after COVID-19 and the mood that we're in right now, I mean, I am so terrified of what's coming in this country. I mean, the popularity of socialism has risen so dramatically because we have discredited capitalism by preaching it and not practicing it. All the damage that has been done to the economy in the name of capitalism has given it a black eye. You know, there are real problems in this country. And I'm very sympathetic with people on the left who point out some real problems. Now, racism isn't one of them. Let's forget about that. But there are a lot of problems. They're not because of racism. They're because of too much government, right? And those problems are real. And I want those problems solved. But I understand that the solutions that everybody has, we're going to make them much worse. And the way we're going to finance it, by printing money. See, we can pretend that we're going to tax the rich. That's not going to work. You know, we've tried to tax the rich before. In fact, people don't know this. The only reason we have an income tax is because we were going to tax the rich in 1913. That's the only reason. And the government told the public, if we have an income tax on Rockefeller and Carnegie and Vanderbilt, and it was only going to be like 2%, tiny, little teeny tax, the government said, we'll eliminate tariffs. That's why we had an income tax, to get rid of tariffs, because tariffs were paid by the average American. I mean, people back in 1913 were smart enough to know that consumers paid tariffs. I mean, Donald Trump is trying to pretend that the Chinese pay his tariffs. They don't. Americans pay every tariff that Trump has imposed. They're a tax on Americans. That's what they are. And so what Hoover said, what Woodrow Wilson said was, hey, let's tax the rich with an income tax and we can eliminate these tariffs that the average people are paying. And we made that deal. But now average Americans are paying income taxes at levels far higher than anything contemplated for Vanderbilt and Rockefeller and Carnegie. So look, taxing the rich doesn't work, right? And you know what? A lot of the wealth that the Bernie Sanders, and I know you had him on the show, and you know, but a lot of the wealth that his ilk wants to tax is going to be destroyed by the very taxes that they want to impose. And they're not going to collect anywhere near the revenue that they think they're going to get. Instead, everything is going to cost much more than they think, and they're going to have to pay for it by printing money. And they're going to destroy the value of the currency.